Our speaker just a moment ago asked me how long the Institute had been functioning, and I said 66 years, which, although he is a cardiologist, he immediately felt his heart in a certain sense of shock, and correctly said that must make the Vancouver Institute quite an unusual sociological phenomenon, which I entirely agreed with. Including tonight, we have 9 more stimulating lectures to fill you up with culture and ideas sufficient to tide you over the dog days of summer. I would like to remind you of some of our future lectures. Next week, in what, by the accident of programming, has become a kind of sequence with tonight's lecture, next week we have Madame Solange Chaput-Roland speaking on Quebec after patriation. That will be followed on February the 20th by Professor Bert Brink of the Department of Plant Sciences at this university speaking on land use in British Columbia, an ecological perspective. Then on February 27th, we have the 1980 Nobel Laureate in Economics, Professor Lawrence Klein, giving the Dalgrauer Memorial Lecture on the subject, Recent Challenges to Keynesian Economic Policies. That will be followed on March the 6th by Professor J. David Singer of the Department of Political Science, University of Michigan, on International Security in the 1980s. So, as you can see, we have many exciting Saturday evenings ahead. And these lectures, as you all know, are free. And you are invited to partake of them as you do of the air you breathe and the sunlight which delights, at no cost to yourself. However, and there is always a however, and unfortunately, I must remind you that considerable expense is involved in providing these free lectures. Food, lodging, travel, postage, telephone calls, and advertisements eat into our very, very limited budget. And also, equally unfortunately, no great philanthropist has taken us under his wing and made us his hobby. And so we are compelled to rely on a form of democratic philanthropy. We depend on the philanthropy of numerous small donations, for which we give you membership cards and a spot on our mailing list. For $2 for a student, $10 single, and $15 for a family, you can experience the pleasure of a noble charitable act. Memberships will be available to you in the hall after the lecture. Please join. Our speaker this evening, Dr. Maurice McGregor, was born in South Africa and graduated in medicine from the University of the Witwatersrand at Johannesburg in 1942. After 4 years of military service, he took postgraduate training in internal medicine and cardiology at the University of the Witwatersrand and at Hammersmith Hospital and the National Heart Hospital in London, England. Since 1950, he has been a full-time academic cardiologist, practicing, teaching, and pursuing research in the field of cardiology. He came to Canada in 1957 to join the staff of the Montreal Children's Hospital, the Royal Victoria Hospital, and McGill University, where he has been to the present time. He has served periods as Director of Cardiology and Physician-in-Chief of the Royal Victoria Hospital and as Dean of the Faculty of Medicine and Vice Principal Health of McGill University. He has served as a Bethune Exchange Professor in Peking Medical College in 1974 and is the recipient of an honorary degree from his alma mater. He is currently professor and senior physician in the McGill University Clinic of the Royal Victoria Hospital. However, it is not in any of these medical capacities that Dr. McGregor will speak to us tonight. He will speak to us in his capacity as a Quebecois. He speaks to us from the vantage point of a keen observer of the political and cultural evolution of Quebec. The title of his talk, An Anglophone in Quebec, could not be more timely at this period of Canadian history. Dr. McGregor.
I hope you don't
add up the value of my contribution to the value of what you're going to put in the kitty when you walk out. I assure you, I'm free. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I find this one of the most awe-inspiring tasks I think I've ever faced. I've wondered, for a start, why did you ask me to speak on this topic? And more important, I'm wondering, why have you come to listen to me? And I suspect, to be serious for a moment, that it's possible that we are both of us here because of an awareness that there is some, that these are quite momentous times, that there's a trembling in the very foundations of the societies we live in and that we've taken for granted. Foundations are structures which shouldn't tremble. They should be so strong we can forget them. But this one is at the moment, and suddenly I think the security of our institutions, things like our currency, the existence of our economic system, they're all in question. And as happens when foundations move a bit, they tend to get some, the superstructure tends to open up a few cracks. And so it is at the moment with the entity we have got used to and which we call Canada. Because cracks have appeared. And we, I suppose, could be called a society this evening of crack watchers. We wonder whether the cracks presage a major falling apart and disintegration, or whether they're just signs of some settling down of the foundations, settling which will result in greater stability hereafter. I suspect, sir, that you might have chosen me because one of the earliest and potentially most dangerous fracture lines in the Canadian superstructure passes down the western border of Quebec. And the Anglophones in Quebec live right on that crack with a leg on each side, so to speak. And we ask ourselves, will the crack widen? And we wonder, why should the crack appear here in Quebec and why now? And we've been doing this since the beginning of the Quiet Revolution 20 years ago, and we think we know some of the answers. So in a sense, we are, at least in relation to this crack, experts. Because an expert is somebody who's thought about it more than the other person. There's nothing so stimulating of the study of the movement of continental plates as to live on top of the St. Andreas Fault. And I presume that it's in recognition of this that you have invited me this evening. So I thank you, sir. And I'll try to tell you about the crack I live on and what it's like living there. The reason for an early fracture line between the language groups in Canada is, of course, quite easy to find. There'll always be potential cracks in human societies, cracks which, under unusual stress, will form along the boundaries of color, religion, language, any other identifiable difference in human beings. Jonathan Swift understood this extremely well when he sent the Lilliputians, who opened their breakfast eggs at the narrow end, to war against the big Indians. This doesn't mean that we'll always fight each other, that Catholics will always fight Protestants and black fight white, but it surely does mean that under stress, when the structure is put under strain, these are where the cracked lines will form, whether this be in Brixton or Ulster. And I think that's quite predictable, that the language line that I've described, that I live on, that that's where a crack should form. Why, after a century of what has at least seemed reasonably peaceful and polite coexistence most of the time, why in Quebec then? Why did the Quiet Revolution start in the 60s, and why has it grown in the 70s? I think you can divide the reasons into two categories. On the one hand, there are those which are general, those which currently are applicable to all the provinces of Canada, those which stimulate each province to assert its autonomy, its rights, its privileges against the collectivity represented by Ottawa. And on the other hand, there are some factors which are local and apply only to Quebec. I won't say much about the former category. I have no special expertise here. You in BC understand the increasing alienation from Ottawa as well as I do. It seems to be experienced by each province as its power and as its potential increases. These, I think, are the same forces of growing self-reliance, which in the past ruptured the old colonial ties with Britain. They're the same forces which rupture the family when the children become adults. Now, as then, there can be two responses to such centrifugal forces. One will recognize the power of these forces, and it will redesign the structure to allow greater local autonomy. The nuclear family, with a dominant father, grows into an expanded family, a loose association of allies. This is the response which gave Canada, stage by stage, its independent self-government. The other response underestimates these forces, tries to crush them, to bind the whole together more tightly. This is the response which caused the American Revolution from Britain. In contemporary Canadian terms, I think our debate is along these lines. It's between those who see the future of the country in greater centralization, a closer union, Ottawa power, and on the other hand, those who advocate preserving Canada by loosening its ties, by decentralization, by turning Ottawa into the center of a real federation of more independent provinces. The present federal government, it's quite clear, Mr. Trudeau in particular, seem to be of the former persuasion. They seem to be quite determined to cure Canada this way, even if it kills her. By contrast, the majority in Quebec is quite clearly of the latter view. And I don't believe that the Quebecois in Ottawa should be confused with the Quebec people or the Quebec government in this matter. It was the understanding of we who live in Quebec at the time of a referendum we recently had on the subject of whether we wished to be independent or not. We were sold on the idea of renewed federalism. And it was our understanding that this meant a new federalism with greater independence for the more powerful provinces from the center. This is still the view of Mr. Ryan and the Liberal opposition. Surprisingly, it is also extremely close to the concept of sovereignty association, sovereignty but association, which is the official policy of the Parti Québécois government.
It's a paradox. One might say that all of Quebec, except for a fairly constant 20%, which does not grow, a 20% which always votes for out-and-out sovereignty, and another 10% which always yearns to put the clock back and waits for the good old days, all the rest of Quebec would be behind the concept of a new federation with more decentralization of certain vital powers. I think these centrifugal forces are common to almost all parts of Canada. There's nothing strictly Quebec about that. And I don't think, therefore, it was at all surprising that the Parti Québécois, the first separatist government of Quebec, found for the first time common cause with most of the provincial premiers, most of the time in the recent constitutional debate. I don't think it's surprising that it came nearer to bringing about a real understanding of the makeup of Canada and a new vision of about what it might be like. I don't think it's at all surprising that the federal government, with its very different view of Canada's destiny, should have striven so hard to prevent such an outcome. And I think people may feel differently about this, but I think their success was one of the major setbacks of Canadian history. Final irony, I think, is that a Quebec-dominated federal government should have dealt in this way with the forces of Quebec and all the other provinces. I don't think anyone else could have or would have. But let's leave that for the moment. That's the common force that I think is rocking relationships across the country. Let me turn to a second reason for the rise of provincial nationalism at this time. And I think it is, again paradoxically, to be found in the improvement of communication of recent years, in particularly of the development of television. Acceptance of our lot, they say, depends on our perception of the gap between what we have and what we might have. You can perfectly well accept life on the lower side of the tracks, so long as you're not too frequently or too vividly reminded of what it's like on the other side, on the right side of the tracks. Now, I think it's beyond doubt that in Quebec, as little as 20 years ago, and somewhat less actually, the French Canadians were usually on the wrong side of the tracks. And the English Canadians, with some exceptions, tended to be the better heeled and to have more power. And the way to cross the tracks was to forget your language and your culture and to identify with the power language and the power society. I think it was television, more than anything else, projecting the very real luxury of the North American home into the relative poverty of the Quebec home and the Quebec tavern, if the home didn't have a television. I think it was this which sparked the awareness of this situation and which started the questions, which started the Quiet Revolution. It disturbed the peace, and I think this stands, for my money, to TV's great credit. But better communication has done more than just disturb the status quo. I think it bears a major responsibility for much of the hostility we find in Canada today. And we can't live with our neighbors with hostility. It doesn't make sense. And so we need to look very carefully at the causes for hostility. Now, I think this sounds heretical at first. It's an accepted axiom of our times, I think, that mankind is basically good and that social hostilities are born of ignorance, and that all we need to do is to know more about our neighbors, and understanding and love will follow. Hence, communication's good, and more communication's better. But good communication, television in particular, has changed our lives in a fundamental way. First of all, it's destroyed our privacy in the sense that I want to tell you about. 100 families can live peacefully in a condominium so long as it has reasonably good soundproof walls. For the brief moments when they emerge from their front doors, they may greet each other on their best behavior, take off their hats and say good morning. But if you remove the soundproofing so that they communicate all the time, so that everything they say can be heard next door, they'll be at each other's throats in a very short time. Their good relationships depend on having some privacy. Mrs. Jones must be able to make a crack about that fat slob next door without being overheard, so that when she meets him on the landing, she can smile and wish him good day. And it was like this in Canada for the first 75 years. In each province, you could make wisecracks about each other without being overheard. You could maintain the slightly dishonest niceties which are socially bonding. The Prime Minister could travel to Vancouver and tell them he favored free trade and low freight rates, and he could go straight back to Toronto and tell them he would fight for protective tariffs and higher freight rates. And by and large, he was only heard by the audience he was talking to. And in English Canada, you could love French Canadians when the only ones that you met spoke beautiful, if slightly accented English, but they looked like us. And you could identify with Louis Saint Laurent and accept him as a leader. And in Quebec, though English prime ministers may not have been able to speak French, one wasn't too aware of this, because you could read about what they had to say in French in the local paper. You didn't hear them talking on your telly. And so you could come to accept them without, I think, really realizing how different they were. But then came TV, and suddenly the living image of the speaker, either speaking English or worse, trying to speak French very often, was projected into the Quebec home. And for the first time, really, the Quebecois met their national leaders right in their sitting rooms, men like Mr. Diefenbaker, face to face, and they asked themselves, could this man really represent me on the world stage? He's so different from me. I've wondered sometimes whether some of the antagonism that I believe I hear, as well as affection, for French, I've wondered whether television may be, in a reverse way, possibly responsible for some of that. I believe if you lived in the West, you knew intellectually and you visited the East, but most of your lives you were not confronted with the living fact that a large chunk of this country actually spoke French. You could live with the awareness that Canada is an English-speaking country. And television, assisted a little bit by our current government, have thrust the fact on us that it is not only an English-speaking country. And this is a very shaking thing when emotionally you have known that it is. So I suspect that the telly's got a lot to blame for, and we should know it and understand it. I don't think it's any coincidence that modern separatism in Quebec was born shortly after the introduction of television. We just started to see each other too closely. We even started to hear each other too well. We couldn't anymore make a Newfie joke in public without it being reported in St. John's. Or let our hair down about the frogs or the wasps or the rednecks that share our condominium. Now we must mind our manners because the neighbors may be listening. And if they aren't listening, the telly will see that they do. But it's worse than that, really. That's a fairly trivial point. The media actually distorts what it tells. I don't mean intentionally and malignantly at all. With some remarkable exceptions, it is interested in strife, slander, what is wrong. It's boring, the other thing. 1,000 polite greetings are ignored, while one insult gets grossly magnified. And you can't live this way with your neighbors. Here's a real paradox for you. Whenever Canada got upset and appointed a royal commission to improve our relationships with each other, it caused a sharp increase in hostility. This was true of the old B&B Commission, and I think it was very true of the recent Pépin-Robarts Commission. I mean, did the media ever tell us about the endless, sensible, good-natured briefs that these commissioners received? They surely did not. But let the occasional hostile bigot appear before the commissioners, and he would get top billing on the national news. Do you remember the time when some poor hysterical female walked up to the commission table where Pépin was sitting in one of the hearings and dumped a packet of dog litter in front of him, screaming, "There's your French for you, stuff it down your own throat, shit, shit, shit." We got this immediately, of course, in every home in Quebec. And it's a deeply shocking message. It doesn't reflect, I don't think for a moment, what the English Canadians think on the language question, but the shock is there. Like the report of some drunks booing "O Canada" as soon as it's sung in French. Now, you know, it's just some drunks doing it. It's not big news, but when you're told about it every time it happens on the national news, it has an impact. Or the recently reported, I hope it wasn't true, remarks of the mayor of Calgary about Eastern bums. Whether he said it or not, the sadness is that the report had to be, again, beamed all over the country as if it was of great moment. I don't think it was taken too seriously. The crack I heard in the bar in Montreal just before I left was, "Hey, do you hear? Trudeau's going to punish the Russians for Poland. What's he going to do? He's going to give them Calgary." What do you think they'll call Calgary when it gets there? Retrograd. And really, humor is the only way to deal with these absurdities. But like the paranoid, anti-English mumblings of some of the ultra-nationalist fringe in Quebec, they are for the most part unhappy, trivial incidents, which just should be forgotten like any other lapse in manners. And that's all they would be until the video camera catches them and puts them on our screens. And when we've had it on the evening news, in case we didn't get the full import, we get it in the morning papers, and then we re-echo it, and we regurgitate it, and we savor it in the weekly review. And so it goes long. As long as the media can find some other bigot to respond to the bigotry, and by such very simple and quite unintentional techniques, I believe nations can be split apart. And I think it's an amazing tribute to the fund of good sense and goodwill of Canadians that most people, most of the time, ignore this stuff. Let me turn now from the causes of some of the tensions which we feel in Quebec, and let me try to tell you what I said I would do, what it's like for an Anglophone actually living there with a foot on each side of the crack. Let me say at once, because I don't think it's necessary, but let me say so, I don't for a moment feel threatened. I don't feel unwelcome. I have never been aware that anyone was hostile to me or to the language which I speak to them. Let me say at once, too, that I can only speak for myself. I am probably very thick-skinned. But that is how it strikes me, so I'm starting from there. There isn't a coherent Anglophone minority that I can speak for. I don't think we even should have one. I think that there is one of the common myths of Quebec politicians, of nearly a million Quebec citizens who are not original French Canadian stock. There are a large number, nearly a half, whose first language is Indian or Inuit or Italian or Greek or Polish or Hungarian or whatever. And of those whose first language is English, there are some whose roots have been in Quebec for generations, but there are very many others, like myself, whose roots are elsewhere. And we don't react exactly the same way to all situations. We're not a community or a collectivity, and there are no collective nouns to describe us, except as maybe Quebecers of non-French Canadian stock, and that's a bit clumsy. Indeed, it's one of our misfortunes that the nationalist front, fringe, I should say, still calls us les Anglais and thinks of us as the descendants of General Wolfe. And this here lies a minor source of friction. In spite of our now being largely bilingual, we don't yet have adequate words which are precise enough in their meanings to assist us in our dialogue, and we desperately need dialogue at this time. Take, for example, the word Quebecer or Québécois in French. To the non-French Canadian, this word tends to mean simply a citizen of Quebec. To the French Canadian born, however, les Québécois, this word has an entirely different meaning. It refers to a group of people who share not only a common language, a common culture, and a common history, the tribe, la nation. And we have entirely different meanings for these words, and we go on ignoring the meaning that the other side has. In English, incidentally, we nearly always use the word nation itself incorrectly, as in Canadian nation, when what we actually mean is Canadian state. The French, always linguistically more precise than we are, use the word correctly to mean a cultural and historic entity. In this sense, you don't become a Québécois, however good your French, by immigrating even from Paris or Haiti, any more than you become a Scot or a Welshman by going to live in Glasgow or Cardiff and becoming a citizen of Great Britain. I mention this because the failure to be precise in this terminology continues to cause misunderstanding and offense. And it's just one of the realities of life there, which you don't experience in a unilingual society. And in any other circumstances, it would actually be extraordinarily funny, this dialogue of incomprehension. Whenever a Francophone, Québécois, says something like this, we, the Québécois, who have successfully defended our French language and culture for over 300 years, etc., 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 he's only got to say that, and some Anglophone will leap to his feet and ask, am I not also a Québécois? I, whose forebears have lived in Quebec for six generations, etc. And the Francophone looks a little bit embarrassed and says, well, sort of. But neither understands that the one is talking about nationality and the other is talking about citizenship. Recently, we have many new organizations of non-Francophone Quebecois. One of them recently published a manifesto in all the newspapers, and one of its statements was, we wish to be considered, I quote, Quebecois in the fullest meaning of the word, unquote. And they were simply saying, we want to be full citizens, full citizenship. An editorial writer of Devoir read this, and he understood them to be claiming full membership of the cultural entity, the Quebecois nation. Just as if a Zambian who went to live in Glasgow would call himself a Scot. And he was deeply incensed at this. So just for the rest of this evening, let me define my terms, because being misunderstood about this is a real drag. When I say Quebecois, I am going to mean a member of the French-speaking nation of Quebec, descended from the early French settlers. And when I say Quebecer, I will mean a citizen of Quebec, whether he be French or English or any other language group. What are some of the other realities of life for a citizen of Quebec who is not a Quebecois? Let me try and list some of them, both good and bad, assets and liabilities. Asset, the privilege of living amongst a population which is vibrant, talented, and immense fun. Asset, the dividend of having to be bilingual. I really mean this. We may not all of us achieve bilingualism, but we're well on the way there. Current figure tells us that about 60% of us are fully bilingual. I mean the non-Francophone Quebecois. That's up about 20% in the last 5 years. The last estimate was about 40%. Of course, all the children are doing a great amount of French in school, but 40% of our children are completely in French school or in French immersion. Of course, if you are of the feeling that does not look on this acquisition of a second language as a dividend, you wouldn't agree that bilingualism and this form of pressed bilingualism is a dividend. Indeed, if you don't enjoy skiing or you don't enjoy French, you shouldn't choose to live in the province which has the most snow and the most Francophones. Asset. The existence in Montreal, at least, of four universities, two French, two English, each with very particular strengths. Here students can take degrees or portions of a degree in one or both languages. By agreement, each university recognizes and gives credit for the courses of the others. Many Quebecers, like the 20% French-speaking students currently at McGill, start their education in their own language and then cross over to sample another one later, either to change language and culture or because there is a particular strength in, as they get more advanced in education, in one of the other universities. Perhaps I should add here, because I've been asked the question, that our government has been remarkably just in its treatment of the English and French universities. McGill, which I know best, has had its fair portion, both of budget and more recently of budget cuts. But it's been a fair deal, and all the universities currently are being rather badly hit. Asset. Here's an odd thing, and I may have a bias here. The strength of the English institutions, particularly the hospitals, institutions which continue to thrive in Quebec without disfavor or discrimination from succeeding provincial governments. Their vigor and striving for excellence is something quite remarkable. I don't know why it is. I think it may be partly because I think they maybe actually owe something to of their quality to their minority statement status. They just have to prove themselves a little harder. It may also be because the English-speaking population is largely excluded or self-excluded from politics and from the civil service. And it identifies with these institutions to an extraordinary extent. The population works for them, it rallies to their defense, and it's maintained them at a surprisingly high level of performance. It's hard to describe this to you, really. Let me give you one example. The single department of medicine of the single hospital that I belong to gives annually about $250,000 to its institution. Of that, 100,000 goes for research in its own department and about 150,000 to the better running and management of its own department. This, of course, quite in addition to its contribution to hospitals' development campaigns and university development campaigns. This sort of thing comes from extraordinarily high morale and high group endeavor. It makes the workplace an extraordinarily pleasant place to be in. What about liabilities? One is the financial crunch. It's very tough in Quebec. We are retrenching ruthlessly in health and in education expenditures because these are the majority of what the state spends its money on. And this hurts, but in the long run, I have to say that I'm glad the government is making a very serious effort to put its financial house in order. I'm assured that this activity isn't unique to our province, but we're working very hard at it. Another liability is a law called Bill 101. It's the bill relating to the use of language. It contains many items, most of which are innocuous and some of which are a source of irritation. Item: public signs must be in French only. I really don't think this worries most people too much. It's so petty and so inane that it is more a source of embarrassment that I'm embarrassed to tell you about it, but you probably know about it anyway, than a source of anger. I believe all language groups, including the French, share this reaction. And indeed, a recent Gallup poll assured me that this was so. Why is it law, you ask, if most of us don't agree with it? I can only say, search me. Doesn't Mr. Bennett's government ever do anything fatuous with which most British Columbians disagree? Item: all who practice a profession in Quebec must pass a French exam. This isn't any big deal either for most people, and the overall justice that we should prove we can serve the public in the language of the majority of the public is quite accepted by most citizens. However, the quality of the exam leaves something to be desired. It manages to fail every now and again some perfectly bilingual people. It is again very profoundly questioned by the broad spectrum of the French people there. What is actively resented, at least by me, and I'm not speaking for anybody else, is that the exam applies only to non-Franco-Québécois. It's as if a driving test were to be applied only to those you think may not be going to be able to drive a car too well. I don't like it because it recognizes in law two classes of citizens, and I don't find that acceptable. A universal driving test is no burden to those who can drive, and a universal language test wouldn't burden the Francophones, and it would reinstate the concept of single citizenship with identical obligations. Item, apart from the few exceptions, English language education is not available to members of other languages and other language groups, or even to English speakers who come into Quebec. Unlike the previous items, this one has considerable support amongst the Quebecois population. The reason for this is fear that through immigration from non-French speaking parts of the world, the Francophone majority in Quebec may come to be eroded and that the Quebecois may come to be a minority in their own land. This has been, of course, a national phobia, frequently but not always justified, ever since Lord Durham recommended and introduced massive English immigration into Quebec with the object of pacifying and outnumbering the French. And it's not an entirely imaginary danger today, when you remember that the province has no direct control over immigration. And most of us accept, I think, that this fear is so great a force that it's a fact of life which will have to be lived with for the present. There has to either be direct control of immigration, and this is a power which can only really come with separation from Canada, or indirect control through such measures as Bill 101. So, not without some regret, most of us now accept that some control over the language of immigrant children is a lesser evil. I believe a temporary one, but I think it's more difficult. Unfortunately, and it's an extremely hard and difficult thing to sell to a voter or to a civil servant or a politician who hasn't worked in or tried to create a center of excellence. For a center of excellence is a very fragile plant. It survives on ideas, and for ideas to generate cross-fertilization is absolutely essential. In the past, there's been no international center of excellence, neither in Alexandria, nor Padua, or Paris, or Heidelberg. None has ever thrived where there has not been free access to the best brains in the world. I think the term today, center of excellence, applies not only to university centers, both French and English, but to complex and advanced industries like CAE and SPAR, which made that famous arm for the recent space shuttle. Such ventures, today as always, will attract the best brains from the world and the highest skills from anywhere in the world. They must be allowed to attract them freely, unimpeded by nationalistic sentiments, whether they be Canadian or Quebecois. So I believe Quebec will have to make exceptions for the children of immigrants, at least to such institutions. And the Federal Department of Immigration, which also offers considerable obstacles to recruitment of this sort of talent, will have to do likewise. And unless they do, I believe such centers of excellence as we have in Canada cannot thrive. Well, you may ask me, where is all this going? Will the crack I stand on stabilize and close? Will the Quebec government soften the items of Bill 101 to which I object? Or will the crack widen? Will isolationism and nationalism increase? And will the non-Francophone minority in Quebec disappear? Will Canada, that experiment in tolerance and good sense, which has up to now been the envy of a strife-torn world, just give up the idea of tolerance between the cultures? The answer, I think, depends on the reactions of three parties. Least of all to the non-Francophone Quebecers, but also to the Quebecois and also to the rest of Canada. What each does will depend, of course, in part on what the others do. As for the Quebecers, some will leave and some will stay and adapt, and the proportions will depend on how history unfolds. The extent to which they have already adapted is, I think, quite remarkable. And no man easily leaves his home. But no man wishes to live where he doesn't feel wanted. Now, I want to stress that I think most of the Quebecers, English-speaking and non-French-speaking, do currently believe that they are welcomed by their Francophone neighbors, but they have a reservation that there may be elements in government which regard them as slightly less than full citizens. So they watch and listen carefully for expressions of friendship or hostility. As for the Quebecois, I believe there is very little awareness of how their minorities feel. And this is typical of us here. I doubt whether there is a wide awareness of how minorities feel in this province or in any other. It's part of how life is. A very minor gesture, such as a modification of the absurd language law in relation to signs, would immediately reassure and stabilize the non-Francophones. Will such a gesture be made? Who knows? If you're trying to guess, in trying to forecast what the Quebecois will do, remember that separatist isolationism and anti-English chauvinism in Quebec took root in soil fertilized by two things: their blatant economic disadvantage until recently, and the danger of their submersion in a flood of immigrants. If this is true, then the roots of nationalism should start to wither, for the economic inferiority and the technical inferiority and the inferiority of achievement are virtually over, and the percentage of Franco-Quebecois in Quebec is again increasing. And indeed, I believe that this is taking part. I think that nationalism is tending to wither. I've lived long enough in Quebec to recall bombs and violent, destructive, anti-English, anti-capitalist riots, things that have not been seen now or even thought about for over a decade. I've seen the transformation of the separatist movement from illegal undercover plotting and outbursts of FLQ-type violence into an open and democratic debate about independence and association. And you've got to hail this as a major step in the right direction, which makes Quebec, for me, a very much more pleasant place, if slightly more challenging, to live in. And the last question, of course, is what will the rest of Canada do about Quebec? Will the bitter fratricidal strife of the federal and provincial Francophones, which has put such a strain on Canada, the eternal Trudeau-Lévesque match, be allowed to continue? Because I'm not sure how much we can all stand. One thing for sure, if you wished to alienate Quebec, one couldn't think of three better steps than these. one should adopt a new constitution without Quebec's agreement or signature. Then, with fireworks and with royal presence, let all Canada, except of course Quebec, celebrate its repatriation. Finally, after this repatriation is over, try to enforce this constitution on a province which is no signatory of it and doesn't recognize it in the first place. If this is the course which is to be followed, I think all the vast store of goodwill and reasonableness will be required to cement cracks together. I believe then that the final answer lies a little bit in your hands as well as in the hands of the rest of Canada, as well as it does in the hands of Quebecers and Quebecois. Should Canada revolve, in spite of the efforts of the federal Liberals, into a looser federation where the larger provinces, like this one, can assume greater self-direction, I think Quebec will want permanent and positive membership. But should the constitution evolve into one in which questions which are vital to the survival of the language and culture can be decided outside the province, then I think the present crack will widen, and that quite quickly. I would like to end my remarks on a personal note. I was asked earlier, why'd you stay in Quebec? There are several reasons. And I stay chiefly because I like it. I stay there because it's home, with all that implies, and I feel comfortable there. I believe my language and my cultural difference are treated with great respect, probably greater respect than I would find as a Quebecois moving outside of Quebec or maybe into the West. But also I'm there because it seems to me that both Quebec and Canada are creations of considerable value. And Montreal, being where the first cracks have appeared between them, is where the action is. Perhaps this is where an individual contribution may do a little bit of creating, of understanding, of gluing the pieces together. Anyway, that's why I accepted your invitation tonight. And for your interest and patience, thank you very much.
We should have some questions.
Dr. McGregor will answer questions, so as customary, I'll ask you to raise your hand. I'll identify the person to ask the question, then I'll ask Dr. McGregor to repeat the question before answering it so that those of you who didn't hear it the first time will hear it when he repeats it. Any questions? Yes.
A two-part question, sir. The practical order of priorities of language and culture and the economic well-being. And secondly, do the PQs not recognize that their interdependence with English-speaking North America?
Well,
in other words, if you erect barriers, it will be worse.
I think the second question I understand, and it says, do the PQ not recognize that the erection of barriers with English Canada will cause their economic situation to deteriorate? The answer is, of course, yes. They are very, very They are in the midst of a battle within their own party at the moment. It's absurd to call it left wing. Their extremist wing is, as I say, for out and out separation. The Premier, his cabinet, his caucus, and I believe 90% of the members of the party absolutely insist on two items. One is that they should not attempt to separate. They should ask for this strange thing in their minds called independence association. But they are insisting on the association, and the fight is whether the extremists may be allowed to ask for independence. The answer is going to be no, I think. The party is having a referendum on this matter at the moment. The second interesting point is that the party is being asked in its present referendum. I forget how the wording of it goes, but it says that we fully recognize the presence and value of language minorities as full citizens in our future society, some phrase like that. Now, I would imagine that, I'll give you my guess, that there'll be a 90% yes vote in that referendum. But that's a question they're asking themselves at this moment. The question is, what do the students think? And do you mean French students or English? Both. I wish I knew, eh? It's jolly hard. I'll give you the snippets that you pick up. I would guess that, in contrast to 10 years ago, the University of Montreal student, which would have been is the biggest university, would have been strongly PQ separatist, or more separatist than the PQ. I have a strong suspicion, and I haven't got a Gallup poll to support this, that he is today far more open-minded. He is far less good recruiting material for the strongly nationalist point of view. He has arrived economically. His parents have arrived. He's becoming part of North America. That may be wishful thinking. The English-speaking student, I think, varies very much. He is not a coherent group, eh? He varies. A recent referendum told me, not that students, but that, it was over 50% of people asked, will your children leave Quebec? The over 50% said, quite possibly or probably. And in the present Quebec, if it stays like it is, or if the hostility situation increases, I don't think they want any part of being a minority in a situation of tension, though they have been very happy to be a minority without the tension, without they perceived it. But those are wild guesses.
Sir, what is the proportion of French Canadians who are fluent in English, and is that being extended through television?
The question is, what percentage of French Canadians now know English, and is that being extended? I don't know. My own figures about the Anglophones' ability in French derive from a recent poll, rather an extensive one, which was done, I think, by one of the newspapers and CBC. There isn't information about the bilingualness of the French until we get it from the next census report, and it either isn't out yet, the one of last year, or I haven't just seen it. I haven't seen any news about it. It is widely believed amongst the Anglophones that their ability, the bilingualism of the French community is diminishing because the school regulations are not permitting them to move into the English school system freely and comfortably. And television is a negative here. It could be an immensely powerful language teacher. But the fight between the owners of television stations and the body which licenses them will not allow a bilingual station or a bilingual radio station. It says, you've got so many for the English and so many French. This is our, what's it called, the federal, CRTC. So it's a disaster, a thing that could be a tremendous educational force. Indeed, instead of having Mr. Levesque talking French with some subtitles in English, which is technically easier, and I could listen to him and catch his meaning, he is always dubbed. It's the same the other way around. When you hear French, I presume it's dubbed. And it's no way to learn a language. It's very sad. That is for sure. The comment was, some of the translations are appalling. You didn't quite say that, but some of them are, and I agree with you. Sir, I detect your accent. If I just may swap a South African term with him, no, it's much more comparable to the AKATIFIA, the Afrikaans Language and Culture Union. An entirely open, anybody can, you know, there's nothing closed or hidden or secret about it. And it's a society, as you might have, I presume, a society here to promote French or any other language. This is a society in Quebec to promote French language and culture. Some of its branches are pretty nationalistic. Not all of them. The Broederbond, which he refers to, is a secret society in South Africa which has had a probably nefarious role in infiltrating and manipulating government and power sources, and I think is not in any way relatable. Question was, do I think that some form of sovereignty association is essential, inevitable, and if so, what is it? If you will understand the words I'm using cautiously, I think some form of increased local autonomy is essential. It was a cliffhanger. We almost got it at the last federal-provincial fight. Every other province wanted it too, and eventually they abandoned one or two minor little items, I think, not terribly important, and which left Quebec out of it. I would have imagined that the concession of complete autonomy over things which might relate to culture, language, education, and the intrusion of federal power into that situation are unacceptable. If you ask the question the other way, the slogan, sovereignty association, what do the Quebecois mean about it? Nobody knows, and they haven't disclosed it, except that it is quite clear that emotionally they do not wish and will not allow anybody to go for saying, we want independence. They want more autonomy, and they sounded extraordinarily like Mr. Bennett and all the other premiers, almost all the other premiers, at the recent federal-provincial hassle.
Could you gauge how much resentment there still is about the 1970 War Measures Act, and who is blamed, or do they blame the extreme separatist extremists, or are they the people who are
I think the answer is yes. May I repeat that question? Is there still resentment about, what was it called, the October crisis of 1970? And if so, who is blamed? And you listed several possibilities, and they're all blamed by different people. Yes, I'll tell you, I think the resentment is particularly in the intellectual, academic, and art people. The sensitive people who, many of whom were scooped up at 1 o'clock in the morning and hustled off to jail for reasons which appear to us now to be entirely ununderstandable. Does most of Quebec, English and French, think that was a giant gaffe? Yes, I think that's the best we think about it. Now that question is being still disputed. Did Mr. Bourassa call in Mr. Trudeau, or did Mr. Trudeau call Mr. Bourassa and say, call me in? And I really don't know. I'll tell you, though, sadly enough, it was Ottawa which took action. The arrests were made under an Ottawa Act called the War Measures Act. And the resentment, I think, is against the Federation of Canada, by and large.
We have time for two more questions.
Sir, in your opinion, why would the Liberal Party, the Federal Liberal Party, be so popular in terms of electoral results when their fundamental policies regarding the Constitution, decentralization, is so at odds with
I suppose.
Repeat.
Thank you. The question was, how come the federal Liberals are so popular if they are so effectively frustrating the will and desire of Quebec as exemplified by its present government? Roughly that you said, huh? And there are two answers to that. There's more than two. Let me give you only two. One is, of course, that Quebec is not 100% behind the attitude of Mr. Levesque at that last meeting, okay? There is a part of most Quebecois, which is very strongly part of Canada. And there is an internal thing, okay? The second thing is that the Mr. Trudeau, who they voted for in the last election, had either overtly or tacitly let the belief get around that he favored a renewed federalism along the lines which the provincial Liberal Party was thumping the hustings for. And I think Quebec voted massively for the federal Liberals because they thought that was what they were going to get.
Last question.
Sir, you were
As the what one?
I think it's called Quebec for Jew. It's a new world.
Yeah. The question was, we aren't a cohesive society, we who do not have French as our first language. And is there a role for a political action group, an association which will be our spokesman? I've asked myself that question very hard. Up to this moment, my answer has been probably not. It's a bit of chemistry which I find a little hard to describe. But I believe that if there were an emotion in this house, in this room, against people who wore green or blue or pick anything you like, it wasn't very explicit. I think the one way you might bring that out, accentuate it, bring out the worst of it, is to have all these guys in green get together and say, let us stand shoulder to shoulder, let us stand up and be counted, etc. It's not like other issues. It isn't a demand for a better economic share. On the other hand, on a particular issue, like whether you may say no smoking in French as well as English, I think that people should well unite. The other thing is, you see, there is not an entity, and I don't think that the French politicians should be allowed to talk its citizens into making themselves into a neat entity. Some of them would quite like it. They would like to have a special law dealing with minorities. But this sort of minority just wants to be left alone to be a citizen. And I don't wish to identify myself particularly as any particular group except a citizen of Quebec, and I'd like my full rights that way. But there are arguments the other way, and it's quite a toughie.
Thank you. Dr. John Dirks, a citizen and head of the Department of Medicine, will thank our speaker.
Ladies and gentlemen, these are momentous times in Canadian nationhood, or perhaps I should say statehood. And as we've heard, these are in many ways issues of the heart. And so it seems appropriate and wise to call on the heart doctor, the cardiologist, to take the history and examine the situation, to make the necessary investigations and come to a diagnosis. And he's done this very wisely, and has given us a prognosis as how it may or may not end. But as the cardiologist knows, the heart is controlled by the higher centers of the body, the nervous system, and so we've seen the consummate physician of reason and action telling us the pros and cons, the advantages and disadvantages of the whole situation as regards the Anglophone in Quebec. He has given us some powerful insights and much food for thought, as it were. I think he has reassured many of us that the future hopes and aspirations, if not security, of the Anglophone in Quebec, as represented by citizens such as Maurice McGregor, bodes very well indeed. He has given us a superb presentation, and we're very grateful to him for it. Thank you.